You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Welcome to the second Cycling Podcast this week. So much going on that we decided to split our coverage into two episodes. And I'm joined, my name's Richard Moore, I'm joined by Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Now, Daniel, you're wearing a cap. Is that an homage to Francesco Moser?
I suppose it is. It's a Gis Gelati, Gis Ice Creams cap.
Very, very appropriate for this week because the one anecdote I know about Gis Gelati is that they sponsored a team in the late 70s and early 80s, and Roger de Vlaminck, our old friend from Belgium, rode for them in 79. And on the eve of Milan-San Remo, the boss of the ice cream company that sponsored the team said that if de Vlaminck won the race the following day, he would give him his Ferrari. And lo and behold, de Vlaminck did win. He won the sprint ahead of Giuseppe Saloni. And after a quick shower, he went and collected the Ferrari keys from his boss and then drove the Ferrari all the way from Italy back to Belgium in one go. There you go.
Nice.
And chaps, there are a few notable ice cream references in cycling, aren't there? There were other teams, the San Montana team in the early 70s. There was a time when the Tour yellow jersey was sponsored by Miko, was it not?
Yeah.
Was that just the yellow jersey in the early 70s? Also, talking about Milan-San Remo, I've talked about this before, but I remember a story about the traditional morning breakaway, the sort of dew sweepers in San Remo one year. Filippo Simeone, the Italian rider, once told the story of how, well, they'd all got caught and a few of them had stopped together for an ice cream somewhere at the side of the road, which was a nice little story.
Did Andy Hampson not have an ice cream Moser-related juice anecdote during our Giro last year as well, where Moser had stopped to buy a box of ice creams or was given one and shared it around only his teammates or something? There was some story where he didn't share, even though there were spare ice creams. I think he threw a couple away rather than give them to people who wanted them. Oh, loads of ice cream anecdotes, I'm sure. Listen,
we should do an ice cream related episode during the Giro, maybe a kilometer zero, because, well, I can think of a few other things that we could explore. Paolo Fornaciari, the former Psycho Domestique, who became the ice cream making world champion. I think, was he world champion or Italian champion a few years ago? There's another story about, I think, Fuente in the Giro. His GC challenge being scuppered by an ice cream before a stage. So there's a lot there. There's a lot of material.
Federico Bahamonte is at the Tour de France as well, famously.
And how could we forget
Ricardo Rico?
Exactly.
I'm waiting for it.
Ricardo Rico. And we're actually,
this has got to be the centrepiece of the episode.
Well, Rich, I did our Giro hotels a couple of weeks ago, and we're actually passing very close to where the Cobra now calls home and has his own ice cream parlour.
He would be the flake, the strawberry sauce, maybe not quite sure about the strawberry sauce, the hundreds of thousands, all the garnishings on top of your ice cream. Anyway, cracking on, we spoke in our first episode this week about Paris-Nice and the Dr. Richard Freeman case. So if you want to catch up with those events, go back and listen to that episode. In this one, we're talking about Tirreno Adriatico and looking ahead to Milan-San Remo, and we'll hear from a few riders looking ahead to Milan-San Remo and answering the question, how will they stop Mathieu van der Poel? But Lionel, Tirreno Adriatico, what on earth happened at Tirreno Adriatico, please?
Well, I'll try and...
Can you explain it as well as just tell us the results?
I'll try and explain it in three or four words. No, I will explain it. But first of all, the Tour of Britain route for 2021 has been announced, and I thought I'd just quickly run through that because it's going to start in Penzance down in Cornwall with a stage up to Bodmin. Then there's a stage to Exeter, a couple of stages in Wales. Then it's up to Cheshire with a stage to Warrington. Then stage six goes from Cumbria to Gateshead, so that's the northwest to the northeast. And then a couple of stages to finish in Scotland, one that goes to Edinburgh, and then the final stage from Stonehaven to Aberdeen. And looking at all that, it made me think maybe this is the year that I'll go on the road at the Tour of Britain. I don't know what you think about that, Rich. Possible in early September, September the 5th to the 12th. So it comes hot on the heels of the Vuelta, which will finish on September the 5th.
Edinburgh and Aberdeen, two cities I know very well.
I'm sure that's why they put them on the route. I'm sure that's why Mick Bennett.
I nod. Thanks for that, Mick Bennett and Cole. And
I nod them very towards well. Me. Very relevant.
Well, the Tour of Britain did go to Hemel Hempstead a few years ago, which is where I went to school in Hertfordshire. So we're just waiting for wherever Daniel's from for the tour to go there. I mean,
well, they're still trying to find out. So once they establish that, it'll be the Daniel Freeb stage will be announced, I'm sure.
It'll be a real whimsical stage, won't it? There'll be a little break 50 kilometres in where everyone can stop for a cappuccino.
Famously, I don't believe in cafe stops.
It would be held in Italy.
Anyway, Tirreno Adriatico, I mean, what a race, what a week. I mean, it was in the battle of Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico, the two overlapping World Tour stage races. Tirreno Adriatico definitely took the gold medal this year, I think, in terms of just the stature of the riders in the field and the racing and the storylines, and particularly the way it has set things up for Milan-San Remo, the first monument of the season, which is on Saturday, of course. But it was all about Pogacar, Van Aert, Van der Poel, with a cameo from Julian Alaphilippe and a special guest appearance from Mads Wurz Schmidt, who was very much in the Michael Gerger role when it comes to the stage winners from Tirreno Adriatico. Wout Van Aert started the week by beating the sprinters in a sprint and finished it by beating the time trialists in a time trial. And in the middle, Tadej Pogacar, the Tour de France champion, made mincemeat of everybody to win the biggest, most difficult stage of the race. And then, well, Mathieu van der Poel, he had two stage wins, the first of which he crossed the line with his arms folded in celebration just ahead of Wout van Aert. And the second was after just a huge break in which he gained several minutes and going up and over the wall that they had to climb up several times. But that was the race between van der Poel for the stage win, Pogacar, who put the seal on the overall, and Wout van Aert, who was, you know, trying to do everything he could to cling on to the lead. Really quite sensational racing, all capped off with a surprise in the sense that Filippo Ganna didn't win the time trial. The first time he's not won a time trial since racing resumed after lockdown. He'd won 8 in a row before Tuesday's final time trial, but Wout van Aert got the better of him, as did Stefan Kuhn. So there we are, Milan-San Remo at the weekend. And can we see any further than a battle on the Cipressa and the Poggio between Van Aert, Van der Poel, Alaphilippe, possibly Pogacar? Well, we'll discuss who else is going to be contesting the win on Saturday afternoon.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, iWalker. We're very grateful indeed to them for their support. If you would like to know more about iWalker, and especially if you run a small business and would like to know what they could do for you, go to iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. Now, chaps, just before we get into Tirreno Adriatico, it's a busy time on the Friends feed as well. If you're a friend of the podcast, we're delivering lots of content, a lot of it involving Lionel droning on. And actually, when I heard about Milan-San Remo being broadcast in its entirety live, I thought, what about a live podcast? Lionel, you could live podcast Milan-San Remo from start to finish, about 7.5 hours droning on.
Not for me, that, to be honest. No, I'd dry up before they even reached the capo, I think, or the cappy, sorry.
I was curious, chaps. I looked up a couple of other things. Well, one thing that would also take 7 hours, alternative to watching Milan-San Remo, you could watch The Godfather Part 1 and 2. That would about the same duration as we expect Milan-San Remo to be on Saturday.
Well, not quite as long as that is Lionel's series, which has been released this week on reporting on Team Sky. Originally a series of blogs, but you've expanded it a bit. Lionel, is at least one extra installment, and we've been releasing that every day. I'm joking about you droning on. It's an excellent listen, really, really enlightening in terms of, you know, it took me back to the foundation of Team Sky and things I'd either forgotten or had faded in the mists of time. Suddenly, you know, coming back into sharp focus and seeming all the more relevant. It's a really fascinating listen.
Well, thank you, Rich. Yeah, part four of that will go out on Friday. The first three parts, as you say, were articles that I wrote for my own website a few years ago. Part four covers 2012 and the year of Bradley Wiggins winning the Tour de France, of course, but also the year that it, well, it came to my notice that the team had hired Dr. Geert Leinders. And, of course, at the end of the year, several members of the team staff left after the reasoned decision by the United States Anti-Doping Agency into Lance Armstrong and all the doping at the US Postal Service. So trying to pull those all those different stories together and just explain with a bit of nuance how complicated it can sometimes be just getting a handle on facts and information, for one thing. So that's going out for Friends of the Podcast this week. Next week, with the Belgian Classics getting underway, with, well, the racing order, I think, is now the 3 days of Depana and then the Grand Prix E3 Harelbeke and then Gent-Wevelgem, isn't it? Wednesday, Friday and Sunday next week. We're also going to be uploading the Lionel of Flanders series from 2017 in its original five-episode form from Wednesday to Sunday. So if you enjoyed that first time round and want to listen again, you can do so. And if you've never heard it before, well, sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com and become a friend of the podcast. Just a quick one. The friends of the podcast who've paid a bit extra and who are eligible for one of our gifts, either a cycling podcast, friend of the cycling podcast cap or tea towel. Dispatching those is slightly on hold at the moment. I'm not milking sympathy here, chaps. My broken collarbone has meant that I haven't been able to get the production line going, haven't been able to dispatch anything for a couple of weeks. But hopefully by the end of the month, we'll have a new batch of caps and they will all start going out again early in April. And also on that score, thank you very much to everyone who's emailed in, whether it's to wish me a speedy recovery or to comment on our coverage in the Cycling Podcast. Thanks for emailing. A little bit behind with our correspondence, but we do read everything. So thank you very much for writing in. But we'd better crack on with Tirreno Adriatico and the week's racing. I mean, extraordinary.
Well, extraordinary. Where do we start? I mean, I got a sense there were these three Galacticos, weren't there? Vanderpool, Van Aert and Pogacar, with, as you say, Lionel Alaphilippe playing a cameo almost. But it feels almost as though Vanderpool in particular, and to a lesser extent Van Aert, have sort of dominated. And Pogacar, arguably the most impressive performance of all. I mean, Merckx, like, really, that those are the comparisons that are now being made. His run of stage race wins, the manner of the victories, the level of his performances are just extraordinary. But I think you began with a reading last week, Daniel. I just wanted to read a line from a blog that I read by Kate Wagner. I'm not quite sure the pronunciation. She's an architecture critic and columnist for the New Republic. I know she's a big cycling fan. She writes a very good blog, often about cycling. Of Van der Poel's famous escapade, she wrote, "Mathieu van der Poel, perhaps cycling's most mischievous and ebullient practitioner, decided with 52 kilometres left to go on the stage and halfway through a snack that he was cold." And that's what led to van der Poel's extraordinary attack, with some kind of energy bar hanging out of his mouth at the time. And with other riders beginning to put on rain capes and so on, with very mixed results, it was, the temperatures were plummeting. Vanderpool's solution to that was to take off, and he took this incredible victory. But where do you start with it? I mean, do you agree with that in all the kind of the justified acclaim for Vanderpool and Van Aert, we're kind of missing, in a sense, the main story, which is Pogacar.
I think so, Rich. I mean, we talked last week or a couple of weeks ago when we talked about Strade Bianche. We've been using these a lot of cosmic metaphors recently. But the thing
some
that
of
struck
us more
me,
than others.
Yeah, we talked, you know, you used the word there, Galacticos, and I think that is apt. But one thing that I've been struck by over the past 3 or 4 weeks is purely, well, it's the intensity of the race and the intensity of the confrontation. This is something we've yearned for years. We felt that even within the sort of sub-specialities in cycling, so Grand Tour racing as opposed to classics, we felt that there has been too little direct confrontation combat between the top riders. And we've sort of maligned the passing of the days, you know, of the 70s, for example, 70s or 80s, where you know, I went back and looked at some of the classics campaigns of those years, particularly the period in the early 70s when it was Devlamic against Merckx and Freddie Martins was emerging. And it, you know, just looking back at the results from those days, you get a sense that it was every day. You know, in sprints, on the climbs, in time trials, one guy was winning, the next day it was another guy. And we haven't really had that. And it's lent a real kind of intensity to, well, the emotional dimension of the last 3 or 4 weeks. And also in terms of, you know, I spoke a couple of weeks ago about my difficulty connecting with Van der Poel. Well, it's really felt for the first time as though Van der Poel has been part of the furniture, the road race furniture, part of the road race scene this spring as well. So that's another reason why it's felt very special. And then, you know, against that backdrop, I mentioned the different types of rider, classics riders versus stage race riders. You've got Pog, who sort of gate crashes this festival of one day riders, and Pog incinerates the peloton on stage five. And yeah, we couldn't really believe our eyes, could we?
You're absolutely right, Daniel. It made me think too of these talk. You know, we talk a lot, or there is talk quite often of the narrative that is missing in cycling and the unfortunate clashes between races. As you said, Lionel, Paris-Nice was very much the poor relation this time around in comparison to Tirreno Adriatico, and we did see this. You know, a stacked field of all these great riders coming together and properly racing each other, and you imagine a calendar that was better thought out with fewer races could recreate that on a fairly regular basis. But the extent to which the race was really dominated by those three riders in particular can be illustrated by this question, I think. And that is Lionel, who finished third overall at Tirreno Adriatico.
Oh,
it only finished yesterday.
I didn't see the podium. That is a very good question. And I actually...
Mikel Landa?
Yes.
Well done, Daniel. I was actually going to say, because the two stages where it was more climbers than classics riders, so the stage that Pogacar won, but also stage two that Julian Alaphilippe won ahead of Van der Poel, Van Aert and Pogacar, there was that break on stage two, wasn't there, which had Simon Yates, Pavel Sivakov, Mikel Landa and João Almeida in it. And then Simon Yates had some kind of energy shortage and slipped back. And then the three riders who, if you saw that break up the road in the Tour de France, you would think, wow, this is some racing going on here. And yet the day was still about Alaphilippe, Van der Poel, Van Aert and Pogacar. I mean, I do, you know, Tirreno Adriatico, I remember Daniel saying during the Giro one year, slightly disparagingly of Simon Yates, saying that, you know, all he's done so far is win a Tirreno Adriatico. And I mean, Tirreno Adriatico is a kind of a classics warm-up stage race, isn't it? It's a beautifully conceived event now. It's kind of evolved, particularly with these short, steep climbs that they have on the stage that Van der Poel won, repeated climbs of the same hill. It's not sort of high mountains, is it? It's not even in the same kind of bracket as a Paris-Nice, which is not quite built for as explosive style riding. Tirreno Adriatico has got, it's got all of the ingredients for this cast of riders to really, really come to the fore. And when you see the climbers on the stage that Pogacar won, stacked up behind him, Yates, Higuita, Landa, Quintana, Almeida, Matteo Fabbro even, you know, that was the one stage where you could say this is a proper stage race stage. The rest of it is almost like mini classics. And so I think that lends itself to some really fantastic racing. And I suppose that's one of the things about cycling, isn't it? You want to give the riders of the generation, the riders of the time, the canvas upon which to create their greatest works. And this week certainly did that. I mean, it played into the hands of the men of the hour, Van Aert and Van der Poel in particular. I mean, we're going to talk about Milan San Remo in the next part, I think. But in terms of build-up for Milan San Remo, I mean, do you think it's, you know, it is kind of the perfect preparation for Milan-San Remo rather than, you know, Paris-Nice, which obviously finishes a little bit earlier, doesn't it? And isn't quite the same sorts of stages. I mean, Van Aert and Van der Poel, I mean, this was almost like the, you know, the weigh-in and warm-up for the big fight on Saturday.
Yeah, I did see some people, including Jeroen Swart, the head of medicine at UAE Team Emirates, wondering whether Van der Poel in particular went so deep in that effort that he might struggle to recover fully in time. I saw his father, Adrie Van der Poel, describe it as his greatest ever victory. And you think that's, you know, do you want to sort of waste that to win a stage of Treno-Adriatico if it does take away something from Lance Armstrong? I don't know.
Also, is Treno-Adriatico the longest race he's ever done? It might well be in terms of stage races. So that might be... I mean, I think he's probably... he did Eneco Tour, didn't he? He's done that before, but I don't think he's done anything longer than a week. That might be a little bit of an unknown as well, as far as Van der Poel is concerned and recovering is concerned.
I mean, for all the talk of Van der Poel's stage win, which was spectacular, really, Richard, you mentioned Pogacar. I mean, he won the race. So, I mean, it was obviously an impressive week for him. And his pursuit of Van der Poel in the final kilometres of that stage and sort of eating into the time. Admittedly, Van der Poel would have been tiring by that stage, having been out in front for as long as he had been. But it was still impressive. And he got very close to catching him, didn't he? It wasn't quite... Maida versus Roglic style at the line, but it wasn't far off. I think the gap was only about 10 seconds. And of course, Van Aert was digging in at that point, trying to defend his blue leader's jersey from Pogacar. But I actually think Van Aert's week's work was certainly the most versatile. I mean, as I said at the start, out sprinting the sprinters, we know he can time trial well, but to beat Ganna after the form Ganna's had in time trials. I know this was probably a little bit on the short side for Ganna, maybe. And then to climb the way he did and still be in the shake-up overall, and well, second place overall, admittedly a minute and 15 down, but a real impressive week for Van Aert. And it does, I said last week, we don't really know how Mathieu van der Poel could do in a Grand Tour, and Daniel makes a very good point there about him having not been tested over more than a week or so. Wout van Aert, we know, can last a distance in an event like the Tour de France, was an extremely useful helper for Primoz Roglic in the Tour last year. I mean, the question is almost, you know, how far can Wout van Aert go? What could he win? And it makes me think about the five monuments. And again, looking forward to Milan-San Remo at the weekend, we know that Philippe Gilbert is the only rider in the peloton who's won four of the five monuments. So far, Van Aert has a Milan-San Remo, which he won last summer, and Van der Poel has the Tour of Flanders, which he won early autumn last year. I mean, between them, they're certainly going to win all five, aren't they? The question is, will one of them win all five of those monuments?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Harry's. Now, Richard, I've got a question for you.
Oh.
When was the last time you shaved with a non-Harry's razor?
Oh, Lionel, I wasn't expecting a question, far less a difficult question. I would say maybe 3 years ago.
That would be about right, yeah. So you've basically been using...
Oh, you know the answer, do you?
Well, I
this is disturbing.
I'd pay very close attention to how smooth your face is on our Zoom calls, Richard. No, but that's about how long Harry's have been advertising in the podcast, isn't it? So you've been using their razors since that
first
engagement.
Well, that is not a coincidence. That's not a coincidence. That's because I started using them when they started appearing in the podcast. But obviously, that is a great kind of endorsement, isn't it? They're very good. They're very good quality. So I have no need to look elsewhere.
I should clarify here. You've been buying your Harry's razors for the last 3 years. You just got a trial set.
I did get a trial set. Yeah, and I have been purchasing them ever since.
There you go. And it's, well, it takes the, well, you don't have to go around the supermarket to buy your Harry's razors, do you? Because they just get sent to you.
Indeed.
And if you want to give the trial set a go, then go to harrys.com/cycling and you can get their trial set pack, which comes with a free travel sized shower gel as well. And in the trial set, you get the weighted ergonomic handle, their new 5-blade razor cartridge, rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover. And all of that is normally £14.50, but you'll pay just £3.95 to have that delivered to you. So go to harrys.com/cycling to claim your trial set for just £3.95.
Well, Lionel, you mentioned that Treno Adriatico was the perfect canvas for those three diverse talents to come together and battle each other. I suppose Milan-San Remo is almost a one-day equivalent. You know, it's a race where riders as diverse as Grand Tour winners and pure sprinters can go head-to-head. We're going to see a rematch on Saturday at Milan-San Remo, but without Pogacar, who's taking a break. Rode very well at Strada Bianca, but is not going to be riding Milan-San Remo. Probably needs a break before building up for his bigger targets further down the line. But
he sort of whimsically coasted to about 16th or 17th place, didn't he, last year, without anyone really noticing?
Again, you know, you don't always notice him, do you? He is a baby-faced assassin, almost. He's not, you know, he's very deceptive. I mean, he's still so young, obviously, but the performances he's putting in are almost not being remarked upon enough or creating enough of a stir, I think, because he's got, you know, Van der Poel and Van Aert are kind of more showy, more spectacular. Their performances catch the eye more. Pogacar, though, I mean, if you're trying to win the Tour de France this year and you're looking at him, you're thinking he's the man to beat. How on earth do you beat him?
Well, he and Rog pretty much live on the same street in Monte Carlo, so there might be, I don't know, there might have to be some dirty tricks employed by his compatriot. I don't know, playing loud music.
Is this going to involve the contactless device again, or anything like that?
I don't know, putting something with foul smelling through his letterbox. I don't know, but there. I mean, it certainly looks, based on what we've seen in the last week or so, that it's going to be those two lining up as the favourites, doesn't it?
I must admit, just before we move on to talk about the riders who are taking part, it is a shame. It's a shame for me that Pogacar's not riding on Saturday, because I think it's a race where there's enough people who want to kick things off on the, perhaps even as early as the Cipressa, but certainly over the Poggio, and not come down to a sprint, that you would think that he would be, well, if he was attacking on the Poggio, it would certainly wake people up, wouldn't it? And bring the race to a boil. But UAE Team Emirates, I mean, they've got three riders who could be involved in a sprint finish: Christoph, Gaviria, Trentin in the lineup. So, you know, that perhaps they feel they don't need him. And as you say, more importantly, he's got stage races further down the line where he does have a far higher chance of success. But I mean, do we see Van der Poel and Van Aert as, you know, one and two favourite? If can we separate them, or are they kind of joint favourites? And where does Julian Alaphilippe fit in? Because, you know, in comparison to these two, Alaphilippe's looking almost ordinary, and yet he is the world champion. He did win a stage in Tirreno Adriatico, but not quite on the same level as the other two.
It's a fascinating matchup of their talents, because Van der Poel on his day is the most explosive looking. Alaphilippe can probably sustain it a bit longer on a longer climb. And Van Aert is perhaps not quite as explosive. You remember last year at Milan-San Remo, Alaphilippe got a bit of a gap on him, and Van Aert just kind of clawed him back, and then was he's got a very powerful sprint, hasn't he? So Alaphilippe's probably not going to win a sprint between the three of them. His best chance, and I noticed De Koenig Quickstep, you know, announced their team. They've got Sam Bennett as well, of course, if there's a big enough group at the finish. But I noticed that they've announced that they are not the favourites for the race. They're kind of positioning themselves as underdogs. And I just wonder what Alaphilippe might try and do. Does he even try on the Cipressa instead and get a little group away not including those guys. I don't know, but what about the route this year, Daniel? Because there were obviously changes last year to the route when the race was held. Have any of those carried over into 2021?
Well, the organisers have reverted to a pretty traditional route, not exactly the classic Milan-San Remo route, because a landslide on the Turchino has forced them to take a different route onto the coast. The Turchino, of course, being the first and biggest climb in Milan-San Remo, but it's pretty easy, and it's been replaced by another pretty easy climb, the Colle del Giovo. And from there, it's the classic route with the Capi, Cipressa and Poggio. The fact that the Turchino has been erased, it made me think, I can't remember whether I mentioned it last year, there's a very famous, there was a famous Italian TV show called Portobello, in which people presented their inventions, and there was a famous episode in the late 70s where a gentleman came on and he suggested that the Turchino be bulldozed because it was what was causing the fog in Milan and Turin and all these places where fog caused an awful lot of problems and people to die on the road, so forth. Bulldozing the Turchino, he suggested, would be a way of letting more air into the north of Italy and getting rid of the fog, like opening a window on the north of Italy. But that didn't happen.
Dubious science, that, surely.
A landslide.
That does sound pretty dubious.
Well, yeah. It was very dubious, but it lives on in popular memory. And the Turchino has, as I said, it's been scratched this year because of a landslide. Don't think it's really that's going to make any difference, really, the change. Well, you mentioned the possibility of an attack on the Cipressa, Rich. I mean, of course, the last time an attack succeeded from the Cipressa was 1996. I think Gabriele Colombo won that year, and even that was a surprise. I've seen some comments from Mathieu van der Poel suggesting that he's got something unexpected up his sleeve. I wonder whether there's a danger, and I think there's a danger with all riders with Milan-San Remo of overthinking things. And there's a bit of a pattern of riders doing very well in their first Milan-San Remo. And let's not forget, van der Poel was very much in with a shout last year, but sort of marked out of it. It became very tactical. Everyone was watching him, and he couldn't really move once Alaphilippe and Van Aert were down the road. But I do see this risk. It happened to a certain extent. It's happened with numerous riders. Cavendish won his first one, and every appearance after that was worse. Caleb Ewan was another one, second in his first Milan-San Remo. There have been various other riders, often sprinters actually, Modolo, Bonifazio, Gaviria, Buani, Danilo Napolitano was fifth in his first Milan-San Remo, flagged up as a future winner, and never did anything after that. And I just wonder with Milan-San Remo, we often talk about its sort of simplicity, but also its sophistication. We talk about, it's a kind of fine and delicate race, almost as though it's a kind of fine Burgundy wine that you need to be this great connoisseur to be able to appreciate the nuances of. But there maybe is a risk of overcomplicating it. And I just wonder, does a debutant ride, are they kind of able to be more present? Are their synapses kind of firing in a different way? And rather than riding to a plan that, has maybe been dictated by what they've learned over the years. And, the guys who've tried to mix things up, do things differently, have often not succeeded. I mean, there are examples of riders as well who tried to win for years and years and eventually got there. I'm thinking of Mario Cipollini, had a bit of help from a Spanish gynecologist, allegedly. But that is a risk, I think, in the same way that I think to a certain extent it's undone Sagan in Milan-San Remo. He looked from his first appearance in Milan-San Remo, he looked capable of winning it. And then several editions followed in which he tried various types of attacks and has never succeeded. So, I wonder what van der Poel will do, and whether, knowing as well the way he likes to surprise and he likes to do the unpredictable, I think there's a risk inherent in that.
Can you not see him attacking up the Poggio with the same explosive acceleration that he used on the run into Siena at Strada Bianca?
I think that would be the smart, sensible, obvious thing to do. But
The one thing, the one question mark I have about him is his sometimes his positioning. We saw at Treno some of the bunch sprints, he was quite out of position, and Van Aert is extremely good at, with a bit of help from his team, being in the right place. And he had to do a lot of work to get himself into, I mean, the stage that he won, I forget which stage it was, with that incredible crossed arms celebration. He was very out of position. He had to do a lot of work to get himself into position. And one of the great battles at Milan-San Remo is into the foot of the Poggio, isn't it? And it, you know, you've got to be in that front arrowhead of that, you know, if you want to, because the Poggio is not that long and it's not that hard and it's very, very fast. And so you can't really move up from 30th or 40th place all that easily. And especially if other teams are trying to exploit that possible weakness. It shouldn't be a weakness. I mean, his bike handling is remarkable, but his just his positioning sometimes is a bit off.
Could boredom be a problem? In the sense that we mentioned those 7 hours. And
He hasn't got to watch it. He's just got to ride it.
Well, 200, he has won beyond 200 kilometres. He's won beyond 250 kilometres. I think Amstel Gold was 264 that he won. But he only spent 210 in the peloton, Amstel Gold. And, you know, similarly with Flanders last year, you know, that's not a race where you're likely to suffer boredom. World Championships in Yorkshire, again, I think he failed for different reasons on that day. But, you know, if that sort of impetuous streak that he has, could that possess him and mean that he does attack on the Cipressa and maybe scupper his own chances by doing that? I don't know.
Well, boredom is often a problem for him, apparently. Stijn van den Berg, the giant Belgian classics man from AG2R, was the guy that he used to while away the time with chatting. But van den Berg's retired, so he can't chat to him about motorbikes and other things. I think they were on video games or whatever they used to talk about. So, yeah, that has been said by people close to him that he does get bored in road races. And Milan-San Remo is a race where not a lot might seem to happen, but it's a very complicated race to win, as we'll hear now, because at Paris-Nice last week, I spoke to a few riders who will be either contenders or be in teams with contenders for Milan-San Remo. And we were speaking after Strada Bianca and that incredible performance from Van der Poel there. And so one of the first questions I asked them all was, how do they beat Van der Poel? And we'll hear from Tim de Klerk of De Koninck Quickstep, Oliver Nassen of AG2R Citroën, Yves Lampert of De Koninck Quickstep, Matteo Trentin of UAE Team Emirates, Philippe Gilbert of Lotto Soudal, and Ben Swift of Ineos Grenadiers.
No doubt you watch Strada Bianca at the weekend.
Yeah.
How do you beat Mathieu van der Poel when he's on form like that?
Tim de Klerk, De Koninck Quickstep.
Well, I think we can consider ourselves lucky in the team that we still have a guy like Julian who can compete with him. And of course, we also have, for the rest, a strong collective. But indeed, also opposite the team is not it's also strong. So yeah, it's of course, yeah, we already knew it, Van der Poel, Van Aert. They're going to be big contenders, but I think we are happy we have Julian, and also we have the rest of a strong squad, and I think we can still compete with them. But of course, it's of course somebody to take account to the every race.
It's interesting you mentioned this team. I remember in Depana last year, they were very strong in that race, and they have been strong at the start of this year. Do people underestimate his team, do you think?
I think they are maybe yes, they are not so they are also quite strong. So yeah, I think it's for sure a rider and also a team to take care about. But yeah, I say we are happy we have Julian in his good days. I think he also doesn't have to be really afraid of Mathieu. But yeah, as we saw in Strade, also the power files he put online, these are incredible numbers. Where I, as somebody with a history in training a little bit, it still astonishes me, the numbers that he puts there. Really incredible.
Oliver Nassen, AG2R Citroën.
How do you stop Mathieu van der Poel?
Can you stop him? I don't know, honestly.
I mean, watching that, when he's on that kind of form, do you think he's almost unbeatable?
Well, nobody is unbeatable, but it's a pleasure to watch him, even for the adversaries. It's something unbelievable, and we have to realize that we're witnessing something that you will not see every generation.
I mentioned you've got a really strong classics team now. You've been a bit of a lone wolf the last few years. Are you looking forward to going into these races that I know you love a lot with people like Greg Van Avermaet by your side?
Absolutely, that's the thing. If we can get to the final with guys like Mathieu and Wout and Alaphilippe, then often it gets tactical. Just think back to last fall with Gent-Wevelgem, for example. Then everything is possible. When you're alone, not that much is possible. So,
Yves Lampaert, De Koninck Quickstep.
Did you watch Strade Bianche?
Yes.
What did you think of Mathieu van der Poel's performance?
Yeah, exceptionally strong, yes. Really, really a huge effort he did, yes.
And when you see him in that sort of form, does the question come to mind, how do you beat him?
I don't know. We will see in the race if it's possible to beat him or not.
Do you think his team is underestimated? I mean, I remember seeing you at 3 Days of Japan last year. His team are very strong there, and they've been strong, and perhaps they're underestimated.
Yeah, it's a strong team they have. It's not the big names, but the guys are all strong, and they all ride for one guy. So, don't underestimate the team.
You've got Alaphilippe, obviously, but what other assets do you have in trying to beat him and the others in Tour of Flanders in particular?
Yeah, I think now with Ballerini also who's standing up, Asgreen is also strong, me, Florian. I think we still can do a lot of options to try to beat him.
Matteo Trentin, UAE Team Emirates.
I'm asking a few guys, did you watch Strade Bianche on Saturday?
Of course.
What did you think? And when you see Mathieu van der Poel in that sort of form and able to do what he does, do you think, how do you beat him?
I don't know. I was just happy to be on my bed watching the race, to be honest. Of course, in a day like this, it's really hard to beat him. And proved to be the champion he is. So I have to say, to get there in that really selected group and with all that really strong riders there, it was really good for cycling.
Is that what you think when you see a group like that, but also this generation of riders coming through, that they're really taking the sport and in races like that to a new level?
Yeah, they really rise up the bar again. This new generation coming in, they put the limit into another level. If you see like into Grand Tour and Sky approach and with Wiggins and then Froome, they rise the bar, and now everybody's there, and even higher. And now with them, we rise the bar again from the classic, from the Bohnen and Cancellara time. So I think it's a good thing for cycling, and it just attracts more people to watch, and it's more spectacle. And okay, for us old guys, we need to work even harder, but that's not a problem.
What's the explanation? Is there one? I mean, the people talk about cyclocross. Philip Gilbert was talking about the sort of aggression that guys bring to races even earlier in the race. What is there an explanation for it, or is it a combination of things?
I think it's a combination of everything, because at the end you don't have millions of guys doing what they do. It's only them. So of course it's not that if every single kid in the planet do cyclocross, then they're going to be the next Mathieu van der Poel or Wout van Aert. But I think if you see like in Strade Bianche, you have in the select bunch in the front, basically everyone did something different than road racing in their career before, and that give you like your bag is much more feel about different knowledge of your bike and your body is also more used to different way of riding. So I think this is a combination of everything. If you see like Van der Poel cyclocross, Van Aert cyclocross, Alaphilippe cyclocross, Bernal was in the mountain bike, even today was in cyclocross when he was younger. So I think it's kind of a key.
Philippe Gilbert, Lotto Soudal, who has won 4 of the 5 monuments, the only one missing being Milan-San Remo.
I guess you watched Strade Bianche on Saturday. What did you make of Van der Poel's performance there?
Yeah, it was nice to see, and as many times he was impressive. Yeah.
How do you beat him?
It depends on the finish, but it's always possible to beat him, I think. So, but he's hard to beat. He's really strong. Yeah.
How much do you think of Milan Sanremo? That's the one missing for you. How much does that occupy your thoughts at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I know it's not easy, and it's even worse every year because it's more riders coming and the rivalry is higher. So, yeah, we will see.
The easiest race to finish and the hardest race to win. Do you think that's inaccurate?
Yeah, it's like this. I think even a good amateur rider can finish Milan Sanremo because it's really not hard to finish. But to make it and to win it, or even to make a top 10, is really hard because it's so many riders out there in the final that it's really hectic in the final, yeah.
How do you, just final question, how do you prepare for it here at Paranissimo? What are you looking for from this race to help you prepare for it?
Well, I like to have this block, you know, of 30 hours of racing in the legs this week. And this is already... helps you to become stronger and better for the weeks to come.
Ben Swift, Ineos Grenadiers.
You mentioned Vanderpool there. I mean, did you watch Strada on Saturday? What did you make of his performance and his attack at the end?
Yeah, that was massively impressive. I think even the first one when he attacked to split that group, you could just see it. And I don't think we've seen anybody go as fast into Siena as what we saw Vanderpool go there. But, you know, it's... a couple of guys were texting me saying, bloody hell, that was crazy, that was unbelievable. But he's done it time and time again, you know. It's all right, it's a little bit different in Tour of Britain, but the stage into Kendal that he won, he put like 5 seconds into us in the last 400 metres. And he's done it multiple times, and that's just what he is. And for sure, he's going to do it on the Poggio.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful to them. They've supported us since 2016. And if you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. We had a call with Science and Sport last week, didn't we, Lionel? And we can look forward to some new products arriving soon. Still to be released, but we're going to try out some things with our all the cycling that we're doing and you will be doing once you're back on the bike. How's the recovery going?
It's going well now, Rich. People who know about these sorts of things say that on day 14 after fracturing a collarbone, there's a sudden improvement, and there really was. It was like a switch was flicked, and the sort of constant pain has eased significantly. I mean, this isn't the collarbone podcast. I know I keep mentioning it every week, but
what are you chaps building towards? What are your goals for the 2021 season?
Well, I'm hoping to go on an adventure for Explore in June, which I'm
is this
not
the Scottish quite very exciting one.
Quite
is
not, this the not Scottish quite ready adventure. To reveal.
Or, not revealed
like
yet.
The Scottish play that you can't.
Yeah, it's like the Scottish play. Yeah,
can't mention adventure. It. It's bad luck. Bad luck to mention it. I think I might have mentioned it the day before I fell off my bike. So you know, yeah, I'm not mentioning it again. But no, all will be revealed hopefully very soon on that front. But we'll see.
Well, listen, before we get on with the... sorry,
I wanted to know what are your sporting goals.
Oh, my sporting goals. I don't have any sporting goals. I'm just doing a lot of riding my bike. I ride my mountain bike a lot. And I've started going out with a group here in France of with Jean-Pierre, Jean-Marc, Jean-Charles, and
you're just making those
Jean-Baptiste.
Names up.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And Nico. So it's a nice group that we go out and ride 3 or 4 hours on a Sunday morning, been thoroughly enjoying that, riding in a group again. It's quite exhilarating. I haven't done that for a long time, and it's been fun. And don't really have any goals though in mind, Daniel. I should have. Everybody knows that you need goals, don't you, to really give your training a bit of focus. What are you? I mean, you must have asked us this in order that we would ask you back.
No,
is there
really.
Some speed golf competition this year or
no? Speed golf was wiped out last year. Likely to be I'll be in Germany, so very difficult to play speed golf there. I mean a couple of trail races that I'd like to do. Some vertical kilometers.
How many vertical kilometers are you aiming for?
One
dare
at a time.
I ask.
Running to the moon,
one dare I ask. Just before we get on with a bit more talk about Milan Sanremo and some predictions, let's do Slow Radio. This week's submission, since we're talking about riding your bike, lots of you have been sending in little clips for Slow Radio. Thank you very much. This one comes from Andrew Gifford, and it's really good. It's a clip of him riding over the Brooklyn Bridge in New York City. He says he always loves the sound of the wooden planks that make up the Esplanade rattling safely below me. That and the view of the Statue of Liberty and Midtown Manhattan make this ride a feast for the senses. So here's a flavour of that now.
Well, Rich, I'll take it all back about slow radio. It's been an absolute hit, despite my scepticism at the start. What I'd really like at some point is to have all of the slow radio clips edited together by one of our producers and really crafted into almost a mindfulness track that I could listen to when I want to sort of calm down.
That could be a friend special later in the year, maybe.
Why not?
It's optional. It's optional. We're releasing a lot for friends at the moment, and we try to make it as varied as possible. So that could be something for later in the year. Returning to Milan San Remo, though, what are your predictions? Any Lionel? Let's have a favourite and an outsider from you. Come on.
Can I first ask Daniel why is the race being shown in its entirety? From start to finish, it will be 7 hours, give or take. Why is it being shown for only the first time from start to finish? Is this because of lockdown and
yes,
people are going to be
at
home?
The reason that's been given publicly is that Italy has been plunged back into a fairly strict lockdown, depending on which region you're in. And in theory, fans will not be allowed or shouldn't go to watch the race at the roadside. So Rai Television, which is state television in Italy, has decided to show the whole race.
And also, I mean, if you've ever had the misfortune of catching Italian television, this has got to be quite an improvement on the usual fare, isn't it?
Yes, I would say so.
Lionel, you've had enough time now to think about your predictions. Let's have a favourite and an outsider, please.
Well, I do think that the favourite is Matthew van der Poel, just because I think he can get into a group if necessary. He could go alone and force that group away. He's got a sprint at the finish. He's sort of had the better of Van Aert a couple of times. I think van der Poel is the favourite. But I think it might tip back into the direction of the more conventional sprinters. And if it comes down to a sprint and the likes of van der Poel and Van Aert have been attacking one another on the climb or just, you know, being away, the effort that it's required to get away, if it comes down to a sprint of however many riders, I think outsider Caleb Ewan.
Or Sam Bennett on the hoods. Okay, well, my favourite, I'll say Wout van Aert then, just to be different for favourite, and outsider, Michael Matthews.
God, here we go. Your idea of what an outsider is. I mean, Michael Matthews is literally the fourth favourite.
Okay, then. I'll go to the other extreme then.
I mean, if you were predicting...
What do you want me to say for outsider then?
If you were predicting that a general election, you'd say the favourites are the Tories and the outsider is Labour.
Okay, outsider, Guillaume Martin. How do you like that?
God. Well, come on then, Daniel. Can we have an 18 favourites coming on?
Let's have the prediction of someone else first. Should we hear from our old mate, Ciro Scognamiglio of La Gazzetta dello Sport?
Dear listeners, just came back from Tirreno Adriatico, the race of the two seas. So, it's a good race for me. Certainly, four seas are better than two, but two are better than zero. But apart of this, thinking about Milan-San Remo. So, my bet for the first monument of the year, I would say among the three best riders, apparently, my bet is Wout van Aert, then Alaphilippe, and then Mathieu van der Poel. But maybe this is too easy. So it's also interesting to see my bet among the dark horses, as you say in English. So, first one, Aramburu Alex. Second one, Fabio Felline. Third one, Nicolò Bonifazio.
Daniel, I've changed my outsider's Michael Gogol.
Oh my God.
It's due a big win.
Daniel, you can't see this, listeners, but Daniel just threw his arms in the air there in a very Italian style gesture. What about Giacomo Nizzolo?
Nizzolo. Well, I haven't got a favourite and an outsider. I've got 18.
Of course.
I've got my list, my time honoured, which we haven't done for a while, my list of the 18 riders, in my opinion, most or likely
there, to win. There better not be any obvious ones on here,
ascending,
Daniel.
Well, some of them will be obvious. Ascending, if that does that mean.
So the least likely last? First. Yeah.
Least
most likely
first.
Last, yeah.
So okay,
you're winner last.
Basically. Here we go. Crow Anderson, 18. Buani, Bettiol, Christophe, Laporte, Ackermann, pronounced in the Colombian way, Moric, Ewan, Demar, Ballerini, Sagan, Matthews, Bennett, Pedersen, Alaphilippe, Van der Poel, Van Aert, and number one, Ganna, Filippo Ganna.
I was going to say Ganna.
Well, Ganna, as I think I revealed on the podcast a few weeks ago, I've had a bet on Ganna already, and I was delighted today to learn that La Gazzetta dello Sport agrees with me. They did a big piece flagging up Ganna's chances, quotes from, among others, the a former winner of Milan-San Remo, Pippo Pozzato, the peacock of San Rigo, and Fabian Cancellara, in fact. And their hypothesis, both of those riders, former winners of Milan-San Remo, their hypothesis is pretty much the same as mine, that there's that moment in Milan-San Remo when the riders kind of, well, they finish the descent of the Poggio and they sort of fall in a jumbled mess on the floor, like, you know, like a kid sort of dropping his toy box and all the cars go everywhere and it's just chaos. And that is the key moment where a rider like Ganna could go away. Of course, Pozzato himself used to try this every year, but he used to try it in the most ostentatious, telegraphed way imaginable. You sort of, you know, he gave out flyers 2 weeks in advance. He swept back his blonde mane and spritzed himself with aftershave. And, you know, it was always pretty obvious when Pozzato was going to go and how he was going to go. But Ganna, you know, Ganna can kind of, he can't necessarily do the 1,000-watt thing, but he can do the sort of 700-watt for, I don't know, 20-second kind of thing. The bottom of the Poggio is 3,700 meters from the line on Via Roma. And, you know, most individual pursuits are around 4 kilometers approximately. And that's his speciality.
They tend to be around 4,000
generally,
kilometers.
Yeah, they're generally 4,000 kilometers. So I think he's got a great chance. He disappointed slightly.
Took it easy in the time trial, didn't
well,
he?
Well, he said he had bad legs.
Took it easy.
He said he had bad legs and he still finished second. So he sort of slipped a few weeks ago. I wasn't the only person
third.
Tipping.
He was third, wasn't he?
Was he?
Was he third?
I wasn't the only person tipping him a few weeks ago, but he's kind of, he's been in the shade, in the shadow of Van der Poel, Van Aert, and Alaphilippe of late, and I think he's got a great chance. When Cancellara did precisely what I think Ganna could do, and also it was a different finish line. It was on the Lungomare Calvino, which was slightly further to the finish line from the bottom of the Poggio descent. Those 3,700 metres, I think, is perfect for Ganna.
Trenton tried it, didn't he? He tried it a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I must admit here, I now don't want Ganna to win. Not because I don't want Ganna to win, but I just can't bear the idea of you being right about this.
Right, and slightly richer. There were some chaps. There were a few guys that I felt slightly guilty about omitting from my list. Kwiatkowski, of course, a serial attacker on the Poggio. Colbrelli, Court, Greg Van Avermaet, Golden
Viviani.
Greg. Radio Viviani, Narsen, Trentin himself, Gilbert, Bonifazio, Nizzolo as well. Nizzolo, I felt guilty because I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. And
you told him then you were going to include him.
And he soared in my estimations because he had the best internet connection I've ever seen. It was extraordinary. I was speaking to him on Zoom and it was like sitting in his lounge.
He'd answered your question before you'd even asked it.
It was like traveling through space and time. It was, and we discussed this. We spent a couple of minutes discussing, you know, the merits of fiber of his particular fiber optic provider in Switzerland.
Well, that is, yeah. I mean, that always leaves a very good impression, doesn't
it? You'll never forget that. Now, every time you see Giacomo Nizzolo, every time he ever achieves anything, now you chaps, you'll be thinking
just
about
his internet connection. Just thinking about his fiber optic cable. Absolutely. He's definitely got a chance, though. I mean, we've spoken a bit about that team, and they've been very present and are on something of a roll. It almost wouldn't be a surprise if they were to pop up with a big win. There is always a chance, of course, that there's all this expectation ahead of the Poggio in particular, and that actually they cancel each other out. It would take a Van der Poel effort like the one we saw into Siena. Just the problem with the Poggio is it's not maybe hard enough, and a long line of riders can go over the top, separated by quite a lot of time, but kind of come back together again on the descent, and that could favour somebody like Ganna, or it could mean that we do see a bunch sprint, and that Zolo could be there, Matthews, Bennett, Sagan, Viviani. Sagan hasn't so far shown anything, has he, that he's in this sort of form? But I've always said that Sagan would win Milan-San Remo when he's not a favourite to win Milan-San Remo.
One thing that really intrigues me, just looking at the teams and the start list, is what Trek are going to do, because they've got some great cards to play.
Don't want to talk about Mads Pedersen.
Pedersen was fourth most likely to win on my list, but I don't know if he's more likely to win, or fifth, sorry. I don't know whether he's more likely to win Milan San Remo or deck the next person, the next journalist who asks him about, you know,
how anything.
Why he's sprinting so well, or what he feels about, you know, becoming more of a bunch sprinter, because last week at Paris-Nice, I was getting the footage back from the mix zone, and I saw his heckles rising by the day every time he was asked about this.
Just a point of information on that. Pedersen does not appear to be on the start list, at least on Pro Cycling Stats, for Trek Segafredo.
Spanner in the works.
Which is surprising, isn't it? But they've still got a very strong team. Nibali obviously won it before. Jasper Stuyven is a good option for them as well.
On my Pro Cycling Stats, Rich, he is on the start list. Hang on a sec.
Daniel's using Nick Solo's internet connection. He's got an update from 10. It will be up in 10 minutes' time.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
Oh, dear. I've got a final question for you both. The whole race is on TV on Saturday, likely to be 7 hours, could be 7 hours 20, depending on which way the wind's blowing. How much of it will you both watch?
My sort of magic number for Milan-San Remo is usually about, this is a guilty admission, but it's usually about 70 kilometres, I think.
if my time was entirely my own, Lionel, I could actually see myself watching the whole thing, or at least having it on and doing other things. I would have it on in the background, which I probably will anyway. But I'd find it hard to justify with other responsibilities spending 7 hours watching it. So I mean, definitely the final couple of hours.
Yeah, I mean, I'm being slightly... Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, I think you can say they absolutely deserve to be on from start to finish. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be on from start to finish. I'm just saying that as a sort of spectator sport, it's a lot of energy to put into watching large parts of the race where very little will be happening. I mean, it is the sort of the test cricket type thing, isn't it? You could put it on and just check in every 20, 30 kilometres, every half hour, just to make sure nothing...
This will be the year that long break succeeds.
Well, there you
Someone
go.
Someone will attack going through a tunnel and come out the other end, and that'll be it.
It's an interesting question, this, because as a spectator sport, I do wonder how many of our listeners would sit down and watch the whole lot of Milan-San Remo. I mean, I don't know. Let us know.
Well, that could be the slow radio clip next week. Could be someone settling into the
7 hours.
Milan-San Remo.
A 3 hour stretch of just gentle snoring at the start.
Hear a can opening. Packet of peanuts being open. Anyway, we should wrap things up for this second podcast of the week. We'll be back next week reflecting on Milan-San Remo and Filippo
minute
Ganna.
By minute coverage on Monday. Seven hour podcast.
Yeah. A reminder that if you would like to get the latest friends special, sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Also, we should say that episode 2 of El Cycling Podcast, the new Spanish language cycling podcast with Rob Hatch and Laura Messiger. Episode 2 is going out imminently. We think Thursday that will be going out, Wednesday or Thursday this week. It's on a different feed. So search for El Cycling Podcast and you will find it if you're interested in the Spanish language version of the cycling podcast. They've got an interview with Miguel Ángel López, Superman, in this week's episode. So that should be well worth listening to if you understand Spanish.
I think I made a terrible mistake. I think Mads Pedersen has never ridden Milan-San Remo.
Never.
But he's probably not going to ride it this time either.
No. Oh, well, never mind.
He's going to be livid when he hears all this.
What a clown.
He's furious. He'll never give you another interview. Anyway, that's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb and Richard Moore. To become a friend of the podcast or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Hugh Owen.